Well, this may burst some bubbles today, but I got to tell it like it is. Hebrew is not a magical language.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
This is Michael Brown. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Welcome to the Line of Fire broadcast. I believe today's broadcast is going to be informative and edifying. We'll smash some myths, but we'll edify you with truth from the Word of God and some insights into the Hebrew language on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Sit back, enjoy the broadcast. I'm not going to be taking calls today, but if you've got a Jewish related question for me, we'll take those calls on our Friday broadcast. A couple of updates from the Jerusalem Post. Israel expects USA Congress to block Iran deal. That is according to a top Likud figure. Now, of course, Likud, Benjamin Netanyahu's party, would be right-leaning. Is this wishful thinking or is this accurate? The report says Israel anticipates that the USA Congress will heed its call and vote down the Iran nuclear deal against the wishes of the Obama administration, the head of the powerful Knesset Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee said on Tuesday, August 11th. Quote, I'm convinced that the American Congress will reject by a large majority the nuclear agreement with Iran, according to Tzachi Hanegbi. There is a plethora of explanations and reasons as to why the agreement weakens the United States. Hanegbi told Israel Radio that the government in Jerusalem was urging members of Congress to view the agreement through the prism, quote, of what was good for their country, not Israel. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu opposes the agreement, as do a number of Jewish groups in the United States. Most Republicans have also said they oppose the deal. And significantly, Democrat Charles Schumer has said that he will vote against it. 94 GOP lawmakers demand the text of the Iranian nuclear side deals. This is according to Newsmax. President Obama, I don't intend to lose the battle over the Iran deal. So things are really, really heating up. American Jews oppose the Iran deal by a 2-to-1 margin, according to another news report. And a study says that Iran terror funding is getting $4.8 billion boost. Terror funding, $4.8 billion under the nuclear deal. So let us be praying for God's best in the situation. This is not a game. I think everyone understands this. And this is not a battle of who's going to win, or the Democrats going to win, the Republicans going to win, is the president going to win? No. These are really life and death issues with tremendous potential impact on the region, on the world. So let's be praying for God's very, very best. Now, many of you know that I've had the privilege of studying Hebrew intensively for many, many years now. As I finish my commentary on Job this month, God willing, have to get everything finished and submit it to the publisher. You got to wrestle through lots and lots of difficulties in the text. Without question, Job is the most difficult book in the Hebrew Bible in terms of the Hebrew language. And of course, philosophically, many would argue that way as well. And then some of the larger challenges of the text. What is the message? What are we supposed to understand here? It's been my joy to dig into Hebrew, the Hebrew Bible and Hebrew literature for decades now. And boy, if I had endless hours a day to study and get into these things, that would be amazing. So it's a rich, beautiful, powerful language, but it's not a magical language. It's not a supernatural language in that respect. It's amazing, it's rich, it's beautiful, just as Greek is for the New Testament, but as other languages are as well. So we want to read it and understand it and appreciate it for all that it's worth without thinking wrong things about it or reading stuff into the text that's not there. So we come back, I'm going to dispel a common myth right here on the Line of Fire.
fire we
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to the Line of Fire on this thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown, delighted to be on the air with you. Sit back, enjoy the broadcast, as I'm going to be doing some teaching, getting in depth on some subjects, and won't be taking calls today, but we'll open the phones to Jewish-related calls as well tomorrow here on the Line of Fire. We're dispelling some myths today, and some about the Hebrew language, some about Jewish literature and things like that. But I happened upon the website ancient-hebrew.org. I've been asked about it here and there in the past, but ended up there looking for something else. I was studying some issues online in terms of the question of the dating of Job, as I was just adding some notes into my introduction, found an article that happened to be on this website. So then I went to the homepage, which says, teaching the ancient biblical Hebrew language of the Bible through the study of the ancient Hebrew alphabet, culture, and philosophy. And it features what is called the mechanical method of translating, a new revolutionary style of Bible translation. The mechanical method of translating is a new and unique translation of the Hebrew Bible, which literally and faithfully translates each Hebrew word, prefix and suffix, exactly and consistently. This method of translation will provide the student of the Bible with a very Hebraic look at the Bible without knowing Hebrew. No, it won't. It will not give them a Hebraic look at the Bible because you're putting it into English in a stiff way that also reads things into the Hebrew text that are not there. So this was just really what was irksome to me. Here on the homepage is the priestly blessing from an ancient Hebrew perspective. False. It is not from an ancient Hebrew perspective. It is manufactured. So here's how we are told that the priestly blessing in number 6 should be rendered. So it has YHWH, so the tetragrammaton in King James or in some older English translations was wrongly rendered as Jehovah, more likely Yahweh, but we don't know 100%. So fine, have YHWH to stand for the tetragrammaton, that's fine. But I'll say Yahweh to make it easier as we're reading it. Here's from the translation from ancient-hebrew.org. Yahweh will kneel before you presenting gifts and will guard you with a hedge of protection. Yahweh will cause wholeness of his being to shine towards you, bringing order, and he will provide you with love, sustenance, and friendship. Yahweh will lift up his wholeness of being and look upon you, and he will set in place all you need to be whole and complete. No, 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 no. That is not what the text says. You will not find a bona fide Hebrew scholar in the world who will say that's what the text says. You will not find a solid philological, scholarly translation in a commentary or any bona fide translation with a team of scholars working on it that will render that. When it starts with the words, Yivarecha ka Adonai v'yishmerecha, the Lord bless you and keep you. If you want to say keep you, guard you with a hedge of protection, you're reading more into it. Okay, the Hebrew does not specifically speak of a hedge of protection, regardless of what this website says. If you want to say guard you instead of keep you, fine. But kneel before you presenting gifts? No. You say, well, they must have gotten it from somewhere. They got it from reading stuff into the text that is not there and manufacturing things in the Hebrew language that do not exist. I can speak to this with some level of authority, and it's not conspiratorial that you won't find a single translation anywhere in the world, a bona fide translation that reads that. You say, well, where do they get it from, even the error? Okay, here's where they get the error from. The verbal form there, levarech, comes from the root barach. Now, the word for knee is berech, And some speculate that originally there was a connection between the noun knee, berech or berkayim, knees, and the verb barach, to bless, livarech, to bless, that there was somehow a connection between them. If there was a connection, it would not be of God kneeling before, kneeling before people presenting gifts, and it has nothing to do with presenting gifts. If there was a connection, it would have been connected to a human being kneeling down in worship and praise and adoration before God. But there is no certainty as to that. Scholars say we don't know if there's a connection or not. There's another word that's related with berech, same root, that has to do with a pool or a pond of water. Are they related? There is debate, but there's no certainty. What we do know, here's what we do know. We know this with certainty, that the verb means to bless. When a human being blesses God, that means a human being speaks good things about God, hence praise. When God speaks good things about a human being, he blesses us, and there is supernatural empowerment with his blessing. But it is 100% false, false, false to say that this should be translated, Yahweh will kneel before you presenting gifts and will guard you with a hedge of protection. Especially that first half is ridiculous. It is not what the Bible says. It is created out of thin air. And it's an absolute shame that some people think that this is now a legitimate translation. Second part, Yahweh will cause his wholeness of being to shine towards you, bringing order, and he will provide you with love, sustenance, and friendship. Oh my. So the first line, Yivarechecha Adonai v'yishmerecha, the Lord bless you and keep you. Ya'er Adonai panav elecha, the Lord causes face to shine upon you, v'chunecha, and be merciful to you. Show you compassion and kindness. It has nothing to do with wholeness of being. The word face has nothing to do with wholeness of being. When God lifts his face on someone, that means show them favor. Oh boy, to shine on someone, that's to be gracious towards someone. Yahweh will lift up his wholeness of being and look upon you, and he will set in place all you need to be whole and complete. So the final line, Yisad Adonai panav elecha v'yasem lecha shalom, the Lord lift his face, meaning show you favor and grant you shalom, and grant you peace, well-being. Some of this is completely off the wall. Some of it largely off the wall. Some of it decently close. How would you like a translation of the Bible that's 10% accurate, 40% pretty far off, and 50% manufactured out of thin air? Boy, oh boy, the Hebrew language is not a magical language. Now, the rabbis played different games with the text. One is called gematria. And in gematria, every letter has a numerical value. So as it is in Hebrew today, Aleph, the first letter, stands for 1. Beit, the second letter, stands for 2. Gimel, the third letter, stands for 3. And so on. And then when you get to the end, you have the last few letters stand for 100, 200, 300, 400. So that did not exist, as far as we can tell, say, in the days of Moses. But the letters being used numerically seems to clearly exist many hundreds of years later, so in the time of Jesus. But this is not the inspired text having numerical value for each word. For example, David, if you take the numerical value of Dalet, Vav, Dalet, D, V, D, that's 4 plus 6 plus 4. That's 14. So could it be that Matthew has 14 names three times in the genealogies because it's David, 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 this is the son of David, this is the greater David, this is the Messiah? Is that what he is saying and that's what he's playing on? It's possible. There could have been other reasons for the number 14 there. But what we know for sure is when God gave called David, or when his father gave him the name David, it had no numerical value. So the rabbis will brilliantly look at this and like every word for some of them, they immediately compute the numerical value, and they would have someone's name and say, well, this person is symbolic of Messiah because Messiah and this man's name have the same numerical count. They're playing games back with the text, and that's just how it was used in some aspects of rabbinic literature, but God didn't inspire it like that. God never gave it like that. It's just like you could play games and assign numerical values like the Roman numerals, assign them to English words and then find equivalencies, but that's not how Shakespeare wrote English. You follow me? Hebrew is not a magical language. It's a rich, incredible, powerful language, and sometimes the power of it very hard to convey in translation, like it is going from any language to another language, but it's not a magical language. Don't go for these bogus websites that try to tell you something else. Trust me on this.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to The Line of Fire on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Michael Brown, delighted to be with you. This is a special instructional broadcast. I'm not taking calls, but to say it once more, if you've got a Jewish-related question, we will take Jewish-related calls on tomorrow's broadcast, the Friday broadcast as well. So I started the broadcast by saying Hebrew is not a magical language. Hebrew and Greek are very, very different languages. And it's significant that we have the Hebrew scriptures, which were given to Israel. And then we have the Greek New Testament scriptures, which were given to Israel and the nations, and then ultimately become the heritage of all the people of God. But the languages are very different. The way they express things is very different. For example, the Hebrew verbal system has a lot of flexibility in it. And Hebrew poetry in particular can use the verbal forms in different ways that sometimes you have to really wrestle as to how to translate it. For example, in Job, the third chapter, is he saying in verse 25, the thing that I feared has come upon me? I always dreaded that the bottom would fall out one day. It seemed like a dream I was living in. The thing that I feared has come upon me. Some would say, well, how could Job have been walking in faith and had an attitude like that? Well, I would say the answer was that everybody has fears, but the fears of the righteous are not realized. In other words, everybody's thought a thought, haven't you? Everybody's been struck, but you know, something's going to go wrong, or you're going to mess up, or something's going to happen to your family. You have a thought that because you love God and you're following him, one of the promises is that the fears of the righteous don't come on us. The fears of the wicked come on them, so this shouldn't have happened. But you could also read it as talking in the present tense, not the thing I feared has come upon me, the thing I dread it's overtaken me, but rather things are so bad now. I'm suffering so terribly that whatever I fear comes on me, whatever I dread overtakes me. You say, but isn't the Hebrew clear? It's part of the genius of the Hebrew verbal system, especially in poetry, that it has certain flexibility. Not so with the Greek. The Greek is very, very precise. And of course, I know Hebrew far better than Greek. But the Greek verbal system is very detailed and can really make it clear that this is a past action that stops at a certain point. This is an action that's continuing. There are different nuances to the verbal systems, and therefore translators have to really understand the languages and how they work. And people that don't understand them well often butcher things, and sometimes with a little knowledge, a little extra information, they come across as experts. They may be well-meaning. They may well love God and his word, but because of only a little knowledge, they can really make a mess of things. Now, I want to read an interesting verse to you, and it's from the 19th chapter of the book of Isaiah, all right? Isaiah chapter 19. Now, there's a dialogue that we have in 2 Kings where the head of the Assyrian army is taunting and challenging the people of Judah. And they say to him, speak to us in Aramaic. Don't speak to us in Judean because we can speak Aramaic. because he was speaking, the Assyrian captain was speaking in a language that the people would understand, the Judean people would understand. And they said, we don't want them to hear this because they're going to get scared if they hear it. Some even speculate that he may have been a Jewish captive, and that's why he could speak the language. Otherwise, he was an Assyrian who knew the language. But look at this. So that's one way of describing the Hebrew language, calling it Judean. But look at this, Isaiah 19:18. In that day, there shall be several towns in the land of Egypt speaking the language of Canaan and swearing loyalty to the Lord of hosts, Yahweh of hosts. One shall be called town of Harris, or some would render city of the sun. Why do I read that? Because it makes reference to the language of Canaan. It's saying the Egyptians will speak the language of Canaan. What language was that? Hebrew. Hebrew is a Canaanite dialect. Hebrew was not what Abraham would have spoken when he was a boy. Hebrew is something that he would have picked up when he came into the land of Canaan, except it wouldn't have been Hebrew then. It would have been some ancient Canaanite dialect that would be closest to what we would call Phoenician. And as this language, this Canaanite dialect, became the language of the people of Israel, it now became their own specific language. They developed vocabulary accordingly. They developed theological concepts accordingly. So there are going to be developments in the Hebrew dialect, but this was a Canaanite language. This was not just something that was kind of came down from heaven and Abraham learned it and then passed it on subsequently. Now, some argue, well, hang on for a minute. Hang on. Obviously, Hebrew was the language in the Garden of Eden, and that's what God was speaking to Adam and Eve with. And look, after all, it says that his name was Adam. That's Hebrew. That's mankind, humankind. Her name, Chava, life, living. She's the mother of all living. She's called Isha, woman, because she's taken out of the Ish, man. Well, you could say it was originally in Hebrew, or you could say that this is putting the original account in Hebrew, because Hebrew is a later language. Hebrew is not as old as say, Babylonian or Assyrian. Hebrew is not as old as Phoenician. Phoenician came first, and the children of Israel borrowed the Phoenician alphabet and then used it for their own purposes, and we know it as Hebrew today. But Hebrew was a Canaanite dialect. Just like American English is an English dialect that we developed from British English, but it's not a brand new language that never existed before. You say, bummer. Why bummer? What's bad? What's negative about that? It's still just as rich. It's still just as powerful. It's still just as beautiful. And it developed in certain ways. It developed in certain ways so that there's a theological vocabulary that doesn't exist in the other languages. There are certain words that were used certain ways, like the word for turn back, shuv. Turn back, turn around, was now not just a geographical or spatial word like you went away, now come back home, but was used with a rich theological meaning. So here is a language that was spoken in the land of Canaan when God called the Israelites, this is your homeland. This became their home language, and they developed it with a rich theology that is unmatched in the ancient world. Is this making sense? I hope so. All right, friends, let me encourage you to stand with us on the front lines of Jewish ministry. Your financial support literally helps us reach Jewish men and women with the gospel. Can I encourage you to join our support team, become a torchbearer, a monthly supporter? Take a moment to go to the website. Would you do that? AskDrBrown.org, AskDrBrown.org. Click on donate. When it says monthly, go there. Read the benefits, all the things we sow back into you. You'll be blessed as you help us reach the Jewish people with the good news of the Messiah.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I do hope you are enjoying today's broadcast and profiting from it on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. It is a teaching day. No phone calls today, but as always, tomorrow, God willing, you've got questions, we've got answers. We'll include Jewish Israel-related questions as well. Let's deal with another myth. We dealt with some myths about the Hebrew language, and there's one more I want to come back to. But let's deal with a myth about the Jewish people. Today's Jews, we are told, are not really Jews. Rather, we are descendants of the Khazars. That was a people that converted to Judaism in large number well over 1,000 years ago. And they are not, obviously, the original people of Israel, the original Jewish people. They are not the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Today's Jews are not really Jews. And you know how you can tell above all? Look at them. You know, they look more European, American than anything. They certainly don't look Middle Eastern. Now, there are native-born Israelis or Middle Eastern Jews, and that's true. So obviously, they're not the descendants of the Khazars. However, look around these Jews, the Ashkenazi Jews, the Jews of Eastern Europe, the Jews that were so decimated by the Holocaust. Most Jews in America today would be Ashkenazic, not Sephardic. Sephardic would be from parts of Africa, Middle East, even Spain. So different people. And not descendants of the ancient people of Israel. Okay. Number one, we can pretty well trace our history. We do have lots of records about where we were, where we lived, migrating from country to country, what we suffered in these different places, how we made it from here to there to there. And religious Jewish literature, while certainly not infallible, is really giving you a continual chain of learning. So we had schools here, we had yeshivot, the places for rabbinic learning here, we had expanded here, we had to move here, this famous rabbi was from here, there. So you can pretty well trace things back long before the time of the Khazars. Is it true that there was a large-scale conversion of the Khazar people? Yes. However, it made up a tiny percentage overall of the Jewish people worldwide, a small percentage of the people as a whole. And some even say that the extent of their conversion is exaggerated. So at most, you had a few more percent added in by conversion to the Jewish people as a whole. But the vast majority would trace their origin back to the people of Israel that lived in the Middle East. You say, well, why don't you all look Middle Eastern? What's the reason for that? The answer is fairly simple, that there was certainly intermarriage. There had to be intermarriage over periods of centuries as Jews lived in different parts of the world. And then with that would be the cultural adaptation and on some level a physical adaptation. But there had to be some degree of intermarriage. But here's the thing. People intermarried, those that intermarry outside of the Jewish people tend to lose their connection. In other words, if a Jewish man in America marries a Catholic woman and they raise their kids Catholic or non-religious, a few generations from now, their Jewish heritage is completely lost, totally forgotten. The only way it's going to be maintained is if someone marries into Judaism. So this would mean that people married into Judaism and converted into Judaism, but they joined with people who were blood relatives. So yes, you can be traced back as a Jew to the Middle East. And not only so, if you look at, say, those who are descended from Aaron or Levi, there are actually genetic markers that confirm a common ancient heritage. Throw out the myth that today's Jews are not really Jews. They're all descendants of the Khazars. False.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, we're going to dispel a few more myths, and then we'll open up some interesting things in the Hebrew Bible for you. How's that on this thoroughly Jewish Thursday? It's come up a few times. I discussed it with Dr. Michael Heiser last Thursday, but let me emphasize this once again. Although the Hebrew alphabet, which was borrowed from the Phoenician alphabet, adopted for the Phoenician alphabet, although the Phoenician alphabet can be traced back to pictographs, in other words, each letter of the alphabet originally had a pictorial meaning, and that's how that letter was ultimately derived or given its name. So the first letter, Aleph, goes back to an ox head and would relate to the word for ox, and Beit, looks like a house, goes back to the word bayit for house. So originally, there were these different meanings. Resh originally would have gone back to some type of meaning relating to head or something like that. These would be the various things that you'll hear and read online. Okay, the argument is not, does the alphabet originally go back to pictographs? The question is, was there a pictographic meaning in the letter? In other words, when someone saw the letter Beit, the B in Hebrew, did an ancient Israelite speaker think that signifies house? No. No, it was simply an alphabet. It's possible in its earliest form, it was what's called a syllabary, that rather than just being a consonant or a vowel, but say initially just a consonant, that the B could have stood for ba or boo or B or different sounds like that for a syllable and not just a letter. But ultimately, when taken over and used by the people of Israel, it was simply an alphabet. When they saw the Aleph, the first letter, they didn't think to themselves, this signifies an ox head. No, when they saw Dalet, the fourth letter, they didn't say, oh, Dalet is Delet, this signifies a door. No, that is complete nonsense. It is bogus. The pictographic meanings had long since lost any related significance. We have developments like that in other ancient Semitic languages where something starts as a pictograph and then develops into an alphabet. By the time it's an alphabet, it is just an alphabet. Now, I've said this before, but I know that this may be new stuff or different stuff for some, so please allow me to repeat this. Did anybody else borrow the ancient Phoenician alphabet other than the Hebrews, the people of Israel? And the answer is yes, the Greeks also borrowed it. So what are the first four letters of the Hebrew alphabet? Aleph, Beit, Gimel, Dalet. What are the first four letters of the Greek alphabet? Alpha, Beta, Gamma, Delta. Aleph, Alpha, Beit, Beta, Gimel, Gamma, Dalet, Delta. So you can hear that similarity. But hang on. The ancient Greek alphabet then went back to the same pictographic alphabet. Does that mean there are pictographic meanings behind the Greek? No, no, no. What a silly, ridiculous thought. But let's go further. The Greek alphabet ultimately influences the Latin alphabet. The Latin alphabet ultimately influences our English alphabet. So instead of Alpha, Beta, Gamma, Delta, instead of Aleph, Beit, Gimel, Dalet, we have A, B, C, D. Ah, very similar, no? Very similar. Now look at the English letter A. Look at a capital A. So it looks like a V upside down and then a line running across it, okay? Instead of that sharp V, make it like an upside down U, like it was a softer top. All right, now take the line that runs across. You got a pen and paper, you can do this. And just draw that line out a little further and just with a slight upturn on either side, almost like a little smiley, all right? Going outside the lines a little. And so you've got the big upside down U, all right? and then you've got the lines going out on either side a little bit like that smiley. You know what that is? That's the ancient ox head. That's what Aleph comes from. Does that mean that when we see the letter A, we should think ox? No, no, no. And when you have 22 letters, there is no pictographic meaning whatsoever. See, if you go back to Akkadian, which is the ancient language of Babylonians and Assyrians, the ancient sign list had over 600 different signs, which originally went back to pictographs. And then they changed from pictographs into what's called cuneiform. That you've seen tablets of that. It looks like chickens have stepped on things. You know, these wedge-shaped writings. Almost looks like chicken feet on them. That's called cuneiform, wedge-shaped letters. They were already originally pictographs. And then when they were adopted by the Babylonians and Assyrians, it wasn't a perfect mix. Taking the ancient Sumerian signs that they use, but there are over 600 of those with different meanings. But you don't have it anymore when you just have 22 letters. So please don't believe this bogus nonsense that the letters must be understood with pictographic meanings. And now someone's going to put something together, you know, ox, head, door. You know, no. Throw it out. It's bogus. It's nonsense. You might as well do it with the English language. It's just as nonsensical. Yeah, you know what frustrates me? That sincere people who love the Lord and who want to dig deep get misled by all this nonsense. You see, there was a time past where it was harder to disseminate this kind of error. There was a time past where you'd have to publish a book. And to publish a book, you'd need a publisher, or at least a publisher to help you distribute it. Otherwise, how are you going to get copies out to people? But now you can post anything online, and you become an expert. You can post anything online just with a little information, and people are like, wow, this is amazing. I never knew it. You never knew it because it never existed. It's false. It's bogus. Oh, Mike Brown, I think you're just a little proud because you didn't know. Oh, gosh. I think you're just stiff religious. You don't want to think out of the box. You know, that's just adding insult to ignorance is all that's doing. that's adding silliness to ignorance. Okay, one more myth. Within the Hebrew Bible are secret codes, the Bible codes. And these codes reveal world events, the names of famous rabbis, chronology, and so on. Well, before you get so excited about this as a follower of Jesus, I want you to know that the rabbis who use these codes as an evangelistic tool to try to reach Jewish people and show them the divine inspiration of the Torah, the divine inspiration of the Hebrew Bible, and they are sincere, they want Jews to return to Jewish tradition. I just want you to understand that the rabbis who teach this will also point you to codes that allegedly show that Jesus is a false Messiah. The fact of the matter is, in order for there have been codes, problem number one is the Bible's written with a language that people are expected to respond to, not with secret codes. So when God gave the Ten Commandments, you didn't have to look up the code meaning of lo tirzach, don't murder, lo tignov, don't steal, or lo tinaf, don't commit adultery. What's the code? Or what are the pictographs? No. They knew what it meant. God was communicating. That's problem number one, that nowhere does the Bible tell us to look for hidden or secret codes. But the bigger problem is this. Just in terms of looking at it statistically and factually, the bigger problem is this, that in order for it to work in terms of, okay, if you count every seventh letter and use computer to do that, or every fourth letter, or skip this and do this and find this pattern, you have to have a perfect text. Let's say that even if we had a perfect text of the Hebrew Bible as it existed 2,000 years ago, the problem is spelling changed. Spelling conventions changed. So just like we spell color C-O-L-O-R, but a few generations back, we used the British spelling C-O-L-O-U-R. and maybe more recently than a few generations, that different words were spelled differently. I remember growing up seeing words that had an E in them, and then the E dropped out, or double letter. If you're going to spell a certain thing, you know, worshiping had two P's, and then it gets corrected on my computer, the one P. I'm like, no, that's worshiping. That's not right. But spelling changed. We know that spelling conventions changed over the centuries so that the way it was written originally is not the way it's written today. With every single letter, there were spelling changes, how words were written. So the whole code thing goes out the window because the counts don't exist anymore. Read the word for what it says and what God meant to say, not looking for some mystical hidden meaning.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, it is our last segment on The Line of Fire on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday show. We've been dispelling some myths, setting the record straight. Myths about the Hebrew language, myths about the Jewish people, myths about the Hebrew Bible, but always with a goal to ground you in the truth. The truth is always better than the fictional version. Not taking any calls today, as it's been a teaching day on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. So I want to show you a little thing in the Hebrew language that's fascinating. Some months back, I talked about it, but I just want to use this as an illustration of something fascinating in the Hebrew Bible. There is a word lo, which the Hebrew letters Lamed Aleph spell it lo, and it means no, not. All right, so it's a negative. So if I say, are you coming today? Lo, you say that in Hebrew to this day. No, no. There's another word that, as spoken today, sounds identical, lo, and that is Lamed Vav. That means to him, to it, for it, depending on the context. So they sound the same, but they are written differently. All right? There are a number of times in the Hebrew Bible where the main text has one of these lows, and then in the margin, it says, use this one instead. Don't read what's written in the main text. Read what's written in the margin. This is a scribal note. And there's debate as to, okay, what is the original text? Which one should we follow? So, for example, in Psalm 100, there's an interesting verse in the King James. And it says this, that it is the Lord who made us, velo, and lo, anachnu, and not we ourselves. Is that it? It is the Lord who has made us, and not we ourselves. We are his people and the sheep of his pasture. Isn't that odd? An odd saying, the Lord made us and not we ourselves. When did people ever think they made themselves? That seems odd, doesn't it? It is the Lord who has made us, not we ourselves. Well, all the other versions for many, many years, virtually all versions, don't read Lamed Aleph, no, but Lamed Vav, to him, for him. It is the Lord who has made us, velo, and his are we, and we are his. And then what does it say, the rest of the verse? We are his people, the sheep of his pasture. So don't read lo, meaning not, but lo, meaning to him, for him. We are his. That's how you say it in Hebrew. There's an interesting verse in 2 Kings, the 8th chapter. 2 Kings chapter 8. The king is sick, and Hazael is sent, the king of Syria, based in Damascus, Ben-Hadad, has sent Hazael, sends him to Elisha the prophet, saying, shall I recover from this sickness? Shall I recover from this sickness? So look at what is written. 2 Kings 8:10, and Elisha said to him, go say to him, you shall certainly recover. Say to him, lo, Lamed Vav, say to him, you shall certainly recover. But the Lord has showed me that he shall certainly die. What? Well, what the prophet would be saying is, yeah, you're going to recover from this illness. The problem is Hazael that you sent to check on you is going to kill you. So the message is, yeah, you'll recover from this illness, but you won't get to because you're going to be killed. Now, that's virtually how all translations read. But what's fascinating is you have a variant in the text. Is it, say, lo, lamed aleph, lo, not will you recover. You will not recover. You will certainly not recover. For the Lord has shown me that you will certainly die. Or Elisha said to him, lo, lamed vav, go say to him, you shall certainly recover, but the Lord has shown me that you will, that he will certainly die. Interesting. And by the way, the Hebrew word vav, or the conjunction vav, just one letter, basically means and, but can have varieties of meaning. It can mean but, it can mean so. It all depends on the specific verse and its meaning. It is very, very fluid in terms of how it can be understood. But you say, well, all right, that's interesting. The Psalm one was interesting. This other one doesn't seem as important. Ah, but when you get to Job 13, that's when it really gets big. Which lo is it? Is it Lamed Vav? Is it Lamed Aleph? What does the text actually say? So the main text reads this, in Job chapter 13, 15, Job is ready to take his life in his hands and wants to have it out with God in a trial and accuse God of not treating him rightly. And he says, look, he's going to kill me. Now, some would translate, even if he kills me. I think it's best to understand as saying he's going to. But either way, if he kills me or he's going to kill me, is it Lamed Aleph? I have no hope? Or is it Lamed Vav? I will hope for him. Or is the meaning, I will wait for it, meaning he's going to kill me, I'm waiting for it. But then the second half of the verse is, yet I will argue my ways to his face. So somehow that has to make sense in the first half of the verse as well. And I take it that Job is probably saying, look, he's going to kill me. I'm expecting it, but I'm still going to argue my ways to his face. But a lot of different translations vary based on which lo it is. You say, how do we decide? You study it and you look at the arguments both ways and you come to your best conclusion. And the overall sense remains the same, that Job, no matter what, was not going to back down. He was going to hold to his ways and say, I do not deserve this kind of treatment. And it was true he didn't. Yet he overstepped his bounds by wrongly accusing God of wrongdoing. All that and a lot more in my Job commentary, which God willing will be out, maybe November of 2016, something like that. Anyway, I just wanted to spend this time clearing up some myths, some misconceptions. If I lost any of you these last few minutes, my apologies. I tried to make it as simple and clear as I could. Again, please pray for us. We have a unique role in ministry, not only to be involved in moral and cultural revolution, not only to be involved in raising up, sending out missionaries around the world, not only to be involved in helping spark revival in the church and equipping God's people to stand, but we're on the front lines of Jewish ministry. We do it with your help and with your support. So please do pray with us. Consider becoming a torchbearer or partner. Go to my website, askdrbrown.org. Click on donate and just look at the benefits as we sow back into you in appreciation as you stand with us. My bottom line today, Hebrew is rich and wonderful and glorious enough without creating things in the language that simply do not exist. Trust me on this.